Huzzah! Welcome to a new episode of Stuck at Home with me, Cliff Dorfman, and this guy.
And I taste a liquor never brewed from tankers scooped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such alcohol. Inebriate of air I am, and debauchee of dew, reeling into endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. I'm Jason Smith.
Wow, that was awesome. Emily Dickinson.
Little Emily Dickinson to start it off. I tried to find, well, you think it's all about sad stuff. Like when you're a kid, you grow up and like that's the one they teach you. Like that's when all the girls turn, you know, like all the kids turn goth in your honors English class and start writing about spider webs. Like I have a whole journal full of like sad, what I call my sad bastard poetry. Like I listened to too much Smiths and like got an Emily Dickinson book.
Hey, Jason, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Who are we?
We are the show that loves films and TV, and we want to share what we like with you.
And we tell you all about the streaming wars, what to stream, where to stream it. All right, Jason, what are you watching?
Well, you know what I'm watching right now?
Tell me.
I'm watching that thing keep growing on your face. This is the.
I thought you were going to let it go. Nope. My mustache.
No, it's great. It's great. I mean, you know, it's always good to have a proud boy in the.
Wait, did Land just write Big Dickinson Energy?
Yeah, he wrote Big Dickinson Energy. That's exactly what Land wrote.
I love Land. Hi, Land. You're the best.
No, we'll get into this more. Is why I got a little sneak preview of season two of Dickinson, which is outstanding on Apple Plus. The other thing I've been watching is I did get into a little bit of that the show about the swears.
Oh yeah, with Nick Cage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But this is what I love about our job. I'm always so hesitant to call it a job because it just doesn't seem like one. But like, we got to watch the whole second season of Dickinson early, which was, I couldn't believe it was work.
Also, you got to cosplay as the community college professor that takes advantage of his newly found poetry protege. So good for you.
They have a guy in there, except he says the opposite. He's like, no, I'm happily married. This is never going to happen. No, sorry. Maybe it is happening. I'm not saying. It might happen. I'm not saying what happened. What I will say. I like it. Yeah, with this mustache, I mean, there's really no other way to go.
What are you going
to
do? Yeah, exactly.
Why does a mustache just reek of predator?
Well, I think because it can hold all the DNA, I think is what the answer is.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
I know, I'm sorry.
It's okay. What I will say, though, is this new season, like, know what a fanboy I was in the first season.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I tried to get you to watch Legion and Doom Patrol, and you're like, nah, yeah, whatever, in a year. You were on this show from the first season. Like, you didn't have to be convinced.
No, the day it came out, I was into it. Well, you know, once you have Hailee Steinfeld, already you know you're dealing with a prodigy and you're going to get something great. And then what Alina has done as the creator and her whole crew and her whole team, I'll say, is something that is, it's like a sustained meditation on the creative process and love. And it's buried, though, within this love story about, you know, friendship and romanticism. It's just this fantastic. It's like, I feel like this is some of the best TV that's out there. And I'm not just saying that because of our guest today. I'm really excited.
I got your back in any court of law, except the one where you go to jail for that for your underground basement filled with
underground fight / sex club.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, Jason, somebody wants to know how long is the beer going to get?
Oh yeah. No, it needs to go every day. It's still here. I keep saying it. Like I wake up, I'll tell my wife, like, you're going to help me get this all trimmed up and cleaned up. I want to cut it several times a week. And we just go, okay, we'll do it in the morning when it's like right before shower time. Like, and then something will happen. And so it just doesn't happen. So the answer is it'll grow forever.
I mean, I'm going to tell you something. In about another week, you're going to need a production designer for that beard.
I know, right? I'm getting ready to do the Captain Lou thing where I just put it in a bunch of rubber bands. But okay, but you've been talking about this show for since it came out first season, since we started talking about Apple Plus. It's like, you gave me this as like a, hey, no, don't worry about it. We got a lot of stuff coming right now. Focus on Dickinson. You're going to love it. And you're right. Because I listen to you.
Thank you. No, and I listen to you, which is why I'm now, you know, neck deep in Legion, which is... right? But we'll get into that. But what I got, the break from Legion was this second season of Dickinson. And I think let's bring him on, right? Because I just want to get into this, right? So without any further ado, production designer extraordinaire of Dickinson, ladies and gentlemen, Neil. Neil Patel.
Hey guys, how you doing?
What's up, Neil? How you doing, buddy? Thank you for
being
here.
I'm good. I'm here working on season three.
Are you really?
Oh, yeah. We're in prep for season three. I'm in the office right now.
Official pickup.
Yeah.
Okay, tell everyone I say hi. Hi.
I will.
I mean, first of all, I have to say congratulations on this season is a tour de force. Did you know this going in? Like, did you feel it? Is there an energy around the production that you just feel you're doing something different?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like it's unlike anything else I've ever done and anything else I think is on that's on television. And I think we have like such an amazing cohesive team led by Elena and Haley. And, you know when something has vision, and this show does. And, every time you do a job, you want it to be the best thing you can possibly, put your best into everything. But when you know something's kind of extraordinary and the way everything, the way you described it, the way it involved poetry and visually bringing that world creative process and the kind of like we kind of crazy psychedelic vision of the Victorian era that we were able to bring out it's just a blast.
Well, okay, so I have so many questions, but I first want to just go back a little because, so many of our stuck at homies, we like to know how this happens, right? So how did you know you wanted to be in production design? And if you could just give me a little of your path, like, did you go to college? Is this something you knew that you always wanted to do?
No, I went to college to study architecture. I always was into, I was like an art kid in high school and always hanging out in the, sculpture, painting. I loved all that stuff. I didn't really know that much about theater or filmmaking at the time. But when I went to college, I got into designing sets for people because I was, an art architecture student. People knew I knew how to make things. And I just totally loved it's really about the collaboration and the social aspect of it and working together with group of people to make something was amazing. And I really started my career in theater design. I studied, I ended up going to MFA program and learning about theater design and moved to New York, worked off Broadway, opera, all that kind of stuff. Got to travel a lot. And eventually through writers I knew in the theater who were making crossover into film and television, I got asked to do my first big production design was for In Treatment for HBO and Warren Light, who is a showrunner. I did his show on Broadway. And that was kind of my leap into that world.
I love that show. That was Gabriel Byrne.
That was a fun show, yeah. Oh, I mean, I don't know if it's good, it's fun. It's an intense show.
No, it was intense, but it was a cool show. Great. I still think about it sometimes, the different clients and everything. That show really left a mark.
Yeah, it's a good show. Really, really good writing and fantastic cast. And
based on an Israeli show.
Yep, exactly. Like a lot of good shows now.
Well, but not Dickinson, because this is the amazing thing about Dickinson too. When we're drowning in a sea of original, of underlying IP, you have Elena and you and team doing something so original and not from the source material, which is just fantastic.
Yeah, it's an invent. It's Emily Dickinson, but it's totally Elena's invention of this, person, this teenager who could be a 2020 teenager in this crazy world.
And you said you did opera, so we're looking at a scene right now. But I mean, you did opera, so that scene at the opera must have really been like, oh, I'm home.
That was that was an amazing bringing together everything that I've kind of done because we got to put an opera production up that was happening in 1859. Mm-hmm. And a television show, which was amazing. And we turned the lobby of an old movie house in New Jersey into a 19th century opera house, which was really cool.
Oh, is that what is that what I was just going to ask you? Okay, so let's go back now because I want to get to that because we're later in the season on this. But I want to start with so was there a football at all? Because I'm seeing a lot of Browns and Blues. Blues seems like to be the prevalent color. Am I off on this?
Blue, yeah, because the big visual change in season two is we have a whole new house. We have Evergreens, which is based on a real house. It was built right next to Homestead, which is a house we see in season one. It was built for Emily's brother, Austin, and Sue. And the Dickinsons spent an enormous amount of money on it, and it was like very much the most fashionable kind of style of architecture at the time. It was a, I kind of describe it as a Victorian Italian villa. You know, it was like, you know, the Homestead house is sort of your kind of classic federal style Victorian, though very beautiful in its way. This is like a much more show. This is a showboat kind of house where it's going to have all these salons with artists and writers and parties. And it's they're spending the Dickinson money on this. On
that
this
they
house.
Don't have.
That they don't have, yeah. They're spending the money they don't have on this house. And the main colors became blue and green. Blue, green, and gold were the kind of signature colors for that set, which really influenced the palette of the season.
Well, so tell me, what was the palette of the season? Was it blue, green, and gold?
Well, blue, green, and gold were the specific colors. And, of course, we have an opera, so that has a lot of gilting and elegant, you know, kind of. But I'd say, in general, there's like a move towards a kind of opulence and a kind of luxury in the world that we hadn't really seen in season one. And that's because what we were introduced as these teenagers are now becoming young adults. They're spending money they don't have, but they're kind of entering the adult world, marriage, infidelity, intrigue, all that kind of stuff that happens.
Yeah, there's a great line that Austin says, where he says, just yesterday, last year, we were kids, and now we're in our 20s. And you know, that was like exactly. In their 40s back then.
That's true. Yeah, because people were dying when they were 32. So,
yeah, but it really leaves a mark when Jane's writing her will out with Austin. You know, it's really a moment.
Right. You know, yeah.
That is, you have to start worrying in your 20s. Like, oh, I'm going to die. I might have 10 years left.
Oh, it's amazing in that period. I mean, death, what you saw in season one, I mean, death was a reality. It, the winter, people didn't make it through the winter. They just died, gut disease, and there was no penicillin. So the death is huge element in this, but this idea, that kind of opulence, and the other big theme, which is not necessarily a palette theme, is this idea of fame that we're really dealing with, and the printing press, and we're kind of making a connection between the print and maybe the technology of today, like social media, and the way we communicate, the way people can become very quickly well known and famous. So that in that first episode, we created a 19th century steam driven printing press. And kind of showing that mechanism, the world is exposed to that.
Well, it's a real paper, the Republican, sorry, right? It was a real paper.
Yeah. And Semples, that's based on a real character who had a correspondence with Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so let's go back to Evergreens. This is a hot set, right, Evergreens?
Yeah.
Is it a location? Did you find a house or did
you
build
this? No, we built the whole thing.
Holy shit.
Tell me about that. Well, the process is we went up to Amherst and we looked at the real Evergreens, and then we came back here and we started thinking about what we wanted to, you know, we based it on the ground plan of the real Evergreens, but the look is different because we're really trying to contour. Elena, really, the directive she gave me was this needs to really contrast the look of Homestead. So when you go into this house, you know, you're in a completely different world. This is a young woman who's aspiring to have like a European salon. So that there's a great deal of like pretense and just showiness to it that needs. So we raised the ceilings. We printed our set decorator. I worked with her to find, she found this incredible process where we printed our own wallpaper on fabric. So the walls are all covered in this fabric. It's something we saw in a museum up in Boston that we liked that for the period, that just gave a sense of like luxury, and the fabric had this beautiful depth on camera. And then she's got this incredible collection of paintings, which is a 19th century collection, but it would have been like the most fashionable thing at the time, right? The kind of paintings she had. She had the American Hudson River School, and then all these European masters. And
well, we meet that artist.
Yeah, and we meet, yeah. So it's like being in a kind of gallery party space that they've created.
I just wanted to ask you something, because I was blown away by the picture walls and all the pictures, mm-hmm. especially in Evergreens. Did you use real, like replicas of real pictures, or were you making your own stuff up?
No, they're real. They're all based on real. They're all real did is it was a long process picking the paintings that I worked at with. We have an incredible set decoration team, and we do different layouts, and they're all real paintings. We print them. We do high resolution prints onto canvas, and then our scenic artists come in and they add texture so it looks like a real painting. So they're all actual paintings. Some of them are in museums. Some of them are in private collections, but they're reproductions of the real deal.
Really? That's very interesting. Yeah. So let me go back a second, because this is just something I love to ask. This is you've done a lot of big jobs. The Path, which by the way is a favorite show of mine. I really love that show.
Oh yeah, thank you.
And I love the starkness of the cult. It's something that was just so interesting. And this is the exact opposite. But why I bring that up is I want to ask, because you've done some big stuff, but now you go in, you meet Elena, right?
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to get it wrong.
Elena.
And can you tell us just a little about that interview process, like and getting the job? Because you still have to do it, right? No matter how esteemed you are, you still have to go in there. And
you do have to do it. And what you do, I mean, the way it works is you get, first of all, it's hard to get the interview. And then when you get the interview, they send you scripts, of course, and then I always present, I think everybody does, I present a lookbook of like my vision for what I, when I'm taking away from the script. And that's part of the interview, is I show pictures of, this is the way I see it. This is what I would do into the season. Because they really want to know, like, besides the function of production designer, what are you personally bringing to the show? What's your take on it? What are your influences and things you like? So I brought together, images and put together, like about a 10-page book just of looks, reactions. I didn't have the whole season. I had a couple episodes, but I knew the big touch, the big points we were going to make visually. So
did you have themes that you went into with it, like that you wanted to explore? Or was it kind of like a collaborative thing where you kind of found it along the way?
Yeah, it's always a collaboration. The thing I brought to it, my background is architecture, so I was really fascinated with this Evergreens house. Mm-hmm. So I had some really specific architectural references, not necessarily partly riffing off the actual historical real building, but we're not a museum show. We're not reproducing
Crown. You're doing something hip.
It's something. So I was looking at a lot of other houses, like Hudson River schoolhouses in particular, that they had the New York money at the time. So they're just a little sexier and more elegant than the New England thing. So I really want to push it in that direction, partly just to make the contrast, and also because those houses are just beautiful and ornate, just a blast to detail as a designer. It's an incredible treat. So that was the main thing. And then the other thing, like with the print, those things, I just wanted to add a sense of scale to the season, because the first season is very internal. We're in rooms, but we're not out a lot. And I really wanted to show like a big, this is the industry of the time. The Industrial Revolution is happening. There's all this stuff going on. We're on a train. We're seeing a giant printing press, just so you get a sense of the world outside of the Dickens's Amherst. So those were my two main sort of ideas going into it. And then it kind of grows and expands, of course, with collaboration.
Of course. Now, did you, this might be a silly question, I don't know, excuse my naivety, but did you have anything to do with any of the carriages as well, or is that a props thing?
That's a props thing. And we have a brilliant prop master. And she finds those. The one thing that was done in season one was the interior of Death's carriage. And that was very much designed. That was designed. I inherited that from the other season, and the set decorator, Marina, who worked with, had done the interior of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now we have Evergreens, right? And then the hedges, that's location, right? Those hedges.
That's a good question. That was a really difficult thing. Yeah.
Blown away,
yes,
by the way.
No. We didn't have a hedge maze. There was no hedge maze on the East Coast that we could use. All the big ones are in Europe. So we had. So what we did is, that's the other great. I mean, I mentioned all these people because I work with such brilliant clients. We have a brilliant visual effects supervisor, Lotta. I worked with her in the maze and the printing press in particular. I had to create enough of a maze that we could shoot the practical scenes of Emily in the maze, and then visual effects grew the maze into the thing you get to see in the show. So we actually, with another brilliant person, our greens person, we had to order and find like 200 trees and plant in the maze configuration that we shot practically.
Oh, wow. So you bought 200 trees.
Yeah. And we planted them, and we made like a mini maze that we could shoot. And then if you saw past that maze, we have blue screen, we extend the maze with visual effects. And then of course we had a drone shot where you probably remember, we just go up and up and up and it expands. Yeah. That only of the very center of it where you see Emily running is real, and everything else is visual effects.
Yeah. And what I also noticed about, which it was mind blowing, really, it's absolutely aesthetically gorgeous. And also, you know, it's very story related, but you also seem to set yourself, was it a concern when you're doing this, because you succeeded either way, but to set yourself apart from The Shining? Because that's really the biggest hedge maze. You know, everyone in film is going to think, oh, Shining, but you made it your own.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a big concern. And we, you know, of course, I looked at all the precedents of maze, you know, The Shining and Harry Potter was the other one that came to mind. Right. You know, mazes, and those are like more sculpted privet hedges, you know, where they're very square. And I wanted this one to be wilder and more Dickinsonian, for lack of a better word. You know, there's something about like her relationship to nature, and you know, because she collected flowers, she had a garden, she was famously connected to birds, insects, flowers, and the connection in her poetry. So I felt like this maze needed to have a kind of wild aspect to it. So that's why it's not all even, it's not perfectly manicured. It's and then in its pattern, it's not geometric right angles, it's organic shapes, which is also, to geek out on the history part of it, you know, that scene is with Olmsted, the designer of Central Park and many other parks. So Olmsted was like a bohemian crazy guy who went, you know, he would go hang out in the place he was going to design the park and like feel the space and figure out how to design it. So this is the beginning of it's the opposite of a kind of structured European French garden. It's an organic, freewheeling, you know, kind of invention. So anyway, that was the impetus for the maze design.
Yeah, and the guy who played, he's from Veep, he played him fabulously. And
great, it was right? Hilarious.
Great. And I kept wondering, like, was this guy in real life a horticulturist? Like, how does he know all these trees and everything? He's like, the scent of it was crazy.
Yeah, he was really convincing, and that was amazing. Amazing character, that guy.
You've had a cavalcade of those come through this season. Jessica Hecht is Aunt Lavinia back.
Fantastic.
But that's why I bring her up, is let's go to The Cure for Wellness. You know, let's go to the water cure. Yeah. How do you pick that spot? Is that a location?
That is a location. Yeah, that's a location. That's an old mansion in Long Island.
Where? And, right by me?
It's near Sands Point.
Kings Point. I was going to say it's Kings Point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, Sands Point by Lido Beach, you're saying.
Yeah, Sands Point. Yeah, Gold Coast, 19th century Gold Coast.
Right.
Long Island. There's a lot of great old houses up there.
That's where I was bar mitzvahed.
That's where you live?
No, I was bar mitzvahed at Sands Point.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, go on.
It's a part of the world there. It's beautiful. Although these houses are incredible. Some of them are falling apart, too. They're very expensive to maintain, as you can imagine. But a lot of them are used for film location. So we found one, and these spas were like another, they were historically, they were all the time. People were going to take these water cures. You know, it's very similar to the kind of wellness culture now, but in its Victorian version. So we wanted it to be a beautiful, elegant space. But then, so we went into that space and it's empty. So we had to bring in all the tubs, and the scene where Jessica's dunked in that tub, we had to build that whole tub. It was hilarious when we shot it because the water to be boiling hot. So our special effects, I think we had it up to freeze or something. It looks like it's freezing cold because she's a brilliant actor, but I remember she was saying like, make it scalding so no one else is standing in it and I'll be happy.
So did you base it on a real spa and anything historic, or did you just take this from your mind?
No, we based it. There was not one particular spa, but we had lots of research of different spas. So like all the treatments are based on things that were really done at the time, like the wrapping and cold blankets, the dunking pool. I mean, those were all real things the mud baths. They did all of those things. They did a lot of like, yeah, crazy. And then, I mean, some of them are so silly, like the one that where Emily's just sitting in a chair and they just dump a bucket of water on her head. That was a real thing.
Yeah, she almost looked surprised. She really looked surprised.
Well, I guess you have to remember it's a time when there was no internal plumbing. So, you know, having a lot of fresh water was pretty, I think just being clean, you felt better. Right?
It's not a joke. It's really true.
Well, we also noticed at the time that people didn't have a lot of fresh water to drink. So if you just went somewhere and took a bath and drank fresh water, you'd feel pretty good in the mid-1850.
Yeah, but it's no joke. Okay, wait. So I want to ask a little bit of a deeper question. And maybe there is no answer to it. Maybe there is. You tell me. Was there, as you get into this, how does the production design relate to Haley's character?
Oh, well, that's interesting. It does because, you know, the show is I mean, we have many characters and we focus on a lot of different characters, but it really is from the point of view. The protagonist of the show is Emily Dickinson. So it's from her point of view, from her. And I think, and this is another aspect of the show I haven't really talked about, which Elena stresses a lot, is there's almost like a surreal, psychedelic quality to the way she sees the world. And that definitely influences the way we create the world. And, you know, this crazy maze, this luxurious house, like it's heightened reality. It's not, like I said, you know, it's not a museum piece. It's not a deadpan realistic piece. It's like looking through, I guess the best way to put it is like looking through the world of a, you know, an artist's eyes, a poet's eyes, and how you see that. So that's definitely a guiding principle in the way we make decisions about the look.
Well, that's really fascinating because really what you're saying is that what we're seeing is not even necessarily how it looks. It's how she thinks it looks.
Right. Yeah. In a way, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, exactly. How she would see it. Totally.
So did the fact that she had this iritis, which I thought was great, did that play into the colors and how you're designing? You know, this idea of how she's seeing things. I guess it did, right?
Yeah, the way things are just heightened. That there, we use a lot of saturated colors. That also has a lot to do with the way our director of photography, you know, like the way everything's lit and the way it's seen. That it's given it's I don't know that, you know, that's not something we ever consciously talk about, but when you say it that way, that's true. The iritis is something that came up in, you know, obviously in season two when she goes to the doctor, but that's, you know, literally you have flashes of light, so and light's how we make images, so it is part of that. And then I just saw the picture of the opera scene, and then yeah. You know, then you see, you know, we very much in that scene see that opera through her eyes, where she's actually projecting, you know, herself on, you know, onto that character that becomes Sue. And that's, you know, a really literal example of the world just transforming into Emily's will.
It really is incredible. I wanted to talk a little more about the opera. So you said you turned an old movie theater into this opera house. And now, did you base this on a real opera house? I mean, I was noticing the lanterns as the floodlights, which was fascinating to me.
Yeah, a lot of the like detail is based on real theatrical equipment of the time. It's really hard to find good pictures of theaters in the United States in the 1850s because the theaters I discovered like burned down every 10 years in the 1850s. So none of them are around. The oldest ones we could find, like the Philadelphia Academy of Music, I think is around 1860. There's a couple, but there aren't many. So there's not a lot of examples to go on. But, you know, there's etchings and historical pictures. And we also wanted to be an opera house of the time in America would not have been as luxurious. It probably would have been a little more austere, mm-hmm. But we really wanted this fantasy. Like they leave Amherst and they go to Boston, they go to the opera. It really wanted to have that kind of romance to it. So it was really hard to find a location. And we went into this, the Lowe's Theater in Jersey City, which is a dilapidated old, beautiful movie house from the 20s. And the theater itself was totally inappropriate. It's like a 3,000 seat theater. It's falling apart. There were cardboard boxes and all the seats. And it's like, but when we walked through the lobby is beautiful and it's a horseshoe shape, like a European opera house. And that was like the moment I walked in is we're just going to do it here. We're just going to build the stage in the lobby and we're going to, and the boxes, it was kind of like amazing because we have all these scenes where the characters see each other across the opera house in their boxes. And that's the way that lobby is designed. It's like a little mini opera house.
Wait, so you, whoa, hold on. You fucking built that in a lobby? You built that entire set?
Yeah, we build the entire set in the lobby. The entire opera house is in the lobby of the Lowe's Theater. Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. And it's yeah, they built really nice lobbies in the 1920s.
Yeah. Well, you really are like a Harold Rourke, huh?
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, it's something special because, I mean, you can walk into a lobby. I mean, I would never in a million years think that was a lobby. And there was so much importance to it. I have to geek out for a second and ask you a question. When she's backstage and, you know, I'm not giving anything away. I just want to ask, when she sees Adelaide May's, you know, dressing room and she's about to go in there. I don't think that gives anything away. I noticed something that was so interesting, that Adelaide May's name is in script above it's almost like engraved in the wall. What was the choice on that? And it was gorgeous, but it was subtle. And it was like, was that something you decided on? Was that something from history? Would they carve her name in it? What was going on there? Sorry, just a little geeky.
Yeah, well, that was, we were, you know, part of it, that's kind of interesting design thing. Cause part of it is like, that's a story point that we needed to make in the design. We need to know that she's seeing her dressing room. And like today, you know, if you go to a Broadway or opera house dressing room, they just have a little name card in the door. That was just sort of our invention of what would, you know, she's supposed to be this, you know, the one of the most famous sopranos in the world, and she's singing
studied with Verdi.
Yeah, they would have done something nice, you know. That's definitely like an exaggeration, but something that like in the story and poetically seemed important.
It did, because it stuck out to me. But now from our interview, it's really, I'm going to have to go back. I think I'm going to watch it again now the whole season, because now I'm wondering, like, is that only how she saw it?
I mean, yeah.
You know, I mean, because it was such a big deal. I mean, she's seeing these women empowered, which is something that we haven't seen, you know, and of course it's
true. Yeah.
Away from her.
Maybe it would have been seen very differently by man at the time, for sure.
Yeah. Or, like a shitty little dressing room. Like, oh, look.
Yeah, her admiration. And also, like, it's like she's meeting a fellow artist, right?
Yes. Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah.
Jed, see, I knew this was going to go fast, Neil.
I know, right? Too fast.
It really does. I mean, I have so many more questions, so I'm just going to say, Jason, do you have anything you'd like to ask?
First, I'd just like to thank you for this show. It keeps Cliff off the street, and so I don't have to go you know, find him and pick him up anywhere. So I really appreciate that. And I really enjoy the show. This is something that I was able to get down with and watch with my daughter, and she actually didn't hate, and we could enjoy it together, which I love.
Good, right?
It's, you know, I, you know, it's one of those things where you have kids and she's 16, but dude, I can't get her to do anything she doesn't want to do. And she was into this. So I'm really appreciative of that, especially. So thank you.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Tour de force, Neil. I see awards. I see all kinds of stuff. So please, when you're nominated, will you please come back and talk to us some more?
Anytime. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. Well, Dickinson, the first season two, first three episodes come out on Friday. And then the rest of the season is going to be released every Friday from there on.
We're so lucky. We got to see the whole thing. Oh, my God. I feel so blessed.
I know.
That's so cool. I don't have to wait. Neil, I can't thank you enough for being here. This has been an absolute pleasure. And please, anytime, come back. This is awesome.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Show, and thank you.
Thank you, Neil. Neil Patel, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
How awesome was that?
Dickinson season two, Apple TV Plus.
Apple TV Plus.
When is it? Friday. It's coming out Friday.
This Friday, three episodes. So everybody else gets to watch three. You already got to watch all of them, but three.
I'm going to watch it again.
I know. And then one every week. Can I just tell you something real quick before we get into it? I mean this all sincerely.
Go ahead.
You know, normally I make a big joke about that it has something to do with my junk and the MeUndies and stuff. Today, I just want to say that I want a pair of MeUndies that look like his
scarf.
Yes.
It looks so comfortable.
It does. It looks gorgeous. I love it.
I can't pull it off, but I started thinking like,
you can pull it off with that mustache. Can you rip the mustache off? Put the scarf on, please. And just don't get me wrong. I'm not going to keep you too long. I know you have a middle school baseball team to coach, but I just want to talk. I got to get this out. I really love that. I love this thing, but when we talk about production design, this is my favorite day to talk about MeUndies, because it just gives me so many ideas. There's actually a bunch of new MeUndies that just came out today. They just started out with, they have a new spaced out version. So it's all like space print, NASA stuff. And
I like that.
Yeah. And constellations and, just, Just shuttles and the moon. So it kind of looks like balls and wings. So I'm also happy about that.
And by the way, everything's still there. It's still $99 a month for the membership, right? Mm-hmm. So you can get that. Every month they send you stuff. By the way, if you don't like it, they'll give you your money back. They don't care. They're winning all across the board, MeUndies. I'm sure some idiots return it. Sorry, no offense. I'm sure some people, very nice, good people, return it, and then they sign back up again.
Yep. No, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure they do, a few people, but and they don't care about that stuff. But they, you know, I think what they rely on is just being really good. So Stuck at Home is offering 15% off if you go to MeUndies.com and use offer code Stuck. And yeah, if I can get that scarf turned into a pair of MeUndies, I'm gonna. Just
or
so
if you
know,
could turn a pair of MeUndies into that scarf.
That's exactly either way. I'll go both directions.
I'm leaving that alone.
Listen, I just want to, you know, go back to the Dickinson show because this is, you know, before we go on to everything else, I just want to say how kind of, you know, how fun this show is and like, why don't they do more of this kind of stuff? Like, it's not the same thing, obviously, but like, what was that show with Sirhan and Sossaman and The Knight's Tale, where you take these kind of fun
Heath Ledger,
and you have these, you know, and Dickinson does it the same thing where you have this really fun version of history. So you kind of feel like you're learning something, but also you're really just engaging in a really cool story from an interesting perspective. Why do you think they don't do more of this kind of stuff?
I mean, I'll tell you what. I mean, I think it really is a writer medium. You know, you have to have a really great writer to do that. And I think that's why Knight's Tale didn't work as well, you know, because the important thing about these things that I notice, and especially what Dickinson does and Elena and her team is that they make a brilliant social commentary throughout. So they're able to parallel what we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. And they're using hip hop music, you know, they're using this lush design. And I think I think it was the first or second episode when they're talking about Sue's salons, she's like, oh, Sue is really an influencer. Like, you know, they're getting into all these
language,
things and they're using this social commentary across the board that is so relatable today. And I think that's a very delicate mix. And it really takes a genius writer or a really well-seasoned writer to kind of get that across in a way where like Neil said, it's not a museum show.
Right. Right. It's a living, breathing and it just that modern feel to some of this stuff. Like, I don't know. Hamilton didn't work for me, but Dickinson does, you know, Knight's Tale does. There's something very different about it to me in the way it's presented. You know, that just feels right. And, you know, I was just curious. It just seems like such an abusable genre that hasn't been abused, which I'm grateful for. Don't get me wrong. Like there's so many different things you could screw up in that way, but, but it just seems like something that would be like a no-brainer. Like, why aren't, you know, you got Chaucer on Knight's Tale, obviously got Emily Dickinson here. Like, we haven't seen Twain yet or Poe, like just a dark, you know.
Poe's
like,
coming. Poe's coming for Poe's sure. Coming. Poe's, I know that. I heard it. Yeah. I just heard it. But it is. Yeah. For
Never
sure.
More.
But
more
it is. It's a deal. It's a delicate balance, man. And it takes a really great writer to find it. You know, to find it, like, for Haley's character to be saying, like, oh, yeah, that's on brand.
Yeah.
You know, like those little lines even. Yeah. For those to work, first of all, you need an amazing cast to pull it off. And really, you also have to talk about the expense of it. You know, it's like they built Evergreens. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I can't even imagine the budget on the show is $100 million.
I don't know. So for real. 50? I mean, it is a lot. I mean, they put a lot
episodes.
Of stuff into it. Yeah.
It's less than $5 million an ep.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's what's really interesting. But now all I want to do now is create the American Authors cinematic universe. So you got Poe, and eventually you're going to get Melville. And then eventually you'll have them all team up and they'll fight Moby Dick. So it'll be just called Dick.
wait. Does Hemingway come in later? Later? But he comes in.
Much later. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
All right. Hemingway's not a bad one, but it's a little more contemporary.
We're all going Victorian, you know, you got the row. You're gonna have like that Doctor Strange one where you go into your brain, you know.
I like that. And then we can do like a Dostoevsky with Crime and Punishment.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, on the other side and then bring it all together into one big
Yes, like they did with The Great. Oh, that's another one. The Great. Yeah,
there's another one. But you know, that's what's funny.
But look at that writer,
ones that do it right. Are like setting themselves up for pure like
gold.
Emmy gold, you know, right? But they have to do it right, and that's what I'm really impressed by this show. I didn't mean to continue on with that. I know we're done with that interview, but I just really think that that's something special that they've kind of come up with. So,
yeah, I know. It reminded me now. I'm just going to say it once. I wrote a line on Entourage where drama just goes about the Emmys. Always wanted one of those little winged angels.
That sounds like actually an Emily Dickinson line. Like if she's going to.
Well, there's a lot of those. I mean, even saying like fame is a fickle food. There's all these great uses of her poetry within the dialogue and still keeping it contemporary. It even makes her poetry feel more contemporary.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, you got Wiz Khalifa there.
Yeah. Oh, but it's teaching kids, you know, it's like, if you're watching this, you're not realizing you're learning something, but you really are.
Right.
And absolutely. I knew a lot about Emily Dickinson's history and her relationship with Sue and like what Sue buried Emily with, you know, this is not this is facts. I don't know what they're going to do in the show. You know, that's years away. My point is that I know a lot about this, and to be able to kind of fuse it together the way they did and still keep the accuracy they have with their relationship, which is really the focal point of the show, and then build it out to this thing that where like kids can go like, oh shit, I get this. I like this. I'm into this. And still my weird brain is like, oh, I'm learning stuff and this is very historically accurate, but yet it's a nice spin.
I like it.
All right. So do you want to talk a little about, I mean, like I could talk about Legion.
Yeah, let's talk a little Legion. Okay. There's not a ton of news.
Speaking of
writing and knowing all that stuff, you do kind of look like you run a small library in the back of a coffee shop, right? Like you're just back there as the proprietor, like take any book you want, just put it back. Shh. When did you teach did you teach an orphan chess once? I just.
Yes, I was a janitor in an orphanage and I taught this young girl chess. Supposedly they made a series out of it. It was in my earlier days when I couldn't get work.
It's fine. It's fine. I feel like I saw you as a background extra in that Queen movie.
I was an extra in a trauma movie called Kabuki Man.
In a trauma movie?
Yeah. Oh, Lloyd Kaufman awesome. Made me an extra in Kabuki Man.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. A thing. It happened.
Yeah. I met Lloyd at the premiere of Father's Day, his version of Father's Day, not the Robin Williams Billy Crystal movie, a very, very different movie. But what a guy. Yeah. Okay. So let's get into that. Cause there really isn't a ton of news of this stuff that I want to talk about in this particular show.
I know there's other news cause unfortunately I couldn't avoid, someone had to tell me. People have to tell me. It's like a thing. Like, listen, I know you don't watch the news, but at least you ask if I want to hear it. You're the only one who asks me. Everyone else just thrusts it upon me. Like Gerard Butler has been thrust upon us since 300. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I don't, why? We got 15 years of Gerard Butler now because one movie. No, that's how I feel.
Here, I got one piece of news that I do want to share.
Tell
with
me what you got.
I'm just going to put this up here. So, this, if you can't tell, this is the Peacock, this is the Peacock pricing structure. Mm-hmm. And so this is the current advertising. They're completely selling Peacock based on what version of The Office, how much of The Office you can watch. They know that that's the only thing they got going right now. So they don't have anything else. So what they're doing is they're basically breaking down their tiers by what versions of The Office. So just so you guys know, if you ever feel like getting Peacock, you don't really need to. And you want to... Free Peacock will allow you to watch the first two seasons of The Office, plus some other stuff. Mm-hmm. If you pay $5 a month, you can get every episode of The Office, plus extended cuts, but tons of commercials. And for $10, you can watch all of The Office without ads. But that is currently how
they're structuring their entire business plan around the Office. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing I think about all of these network streamers, right? I think that they're not going to be sustainable. What is going to happen is that I think there's going to be a bigger streamer that absorbs them, almost like DirecTV absorbed the networks. You know, like, oh, you get NBC, ABC, CBS, and they're still ad-based. I think that's how it's going to be. I think it's going to be like, oh, if you buy, Netflix, let's say, you also get Peacock and for an extra price. Or you can watch Peacock with ads. That's how I think it's going to end up falling. I don't think they're going to be standalones. I don't think it'll last. I don't think, because look at what they're doing. This is idiocracy. I mean, you're basing it on how many episodes of The Office you have. I mean, what is that saying about your library?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It seems ridiculous to me, and I don't think it's a recipe for longevity. That's all I'm saying.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think that, you know, there's better stuff to be in there, but yeah. So tell me about Legion. So you've started Legion now and you've gotten through a little bit of it. How far are you?
I'm almost done with the first season.
Okay. What are you thinking? How are you feeling?
I'm loving it. What's the guy's name? Hero. What's it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Which guy?
The director. Hero.
Yeah. The guy who did, like he does all the music videos. He did, he's like, he did all of Atlanta.
Yeah. This guy, he directed episode, I think it was 6, at least is the one I noticed, which was the freakiest episode I've ever seen. I mean, there's something so esoteric about this show while still being so incredibly commercial. I know I'm late to the party on it, granted, though I'm almost glad I am because I get to binge all 3 seasons. Hi, Steph. I get to binge all 3 seasons. And on top of that, it's getting to watch it sort of myopically, where I'm not just waiting each week for something. Hi, Steph. Where I'm waiting each week. I just like her walking back each time. Hi. I love Stephanie. All right. So where I'm not waiting each week and just thinking about plot points, I'm getting to really immerse into this. I am shocked this show works, let alone that it's great, because this is such a heady show. This is basically inside this dude's head. Most of it is in the astral plane, you know, and how do you put that on paper? I mean, there's a moment where they're in a room and you see on the wall, these eyes appear and they just blink. And it's like, what? Who's thinking of this? And then how is it going on the page? And then how are they actually keeping me suspense? You know, the suspense is there. I'm still on the edge of my seat about it, you know, but yet, even though half the time I'm so fucking confused.
Right. Right.
It makes sense. I mean, you've seen the whole thing. So what is it about it to you that makes it so special?
I think that, you know, I like being confused about it. I like there being a story. It's just not a straightforward tale. Like there's a lot of twists and turns in this as it goes along. It doesn't sit on any of your expectations. It's a superhero movie, but it's not a superhero movie. It's a meditation in like why, you know, it's in mental health, you know, and exploring these people and their pieces. And I don't know, there's just something about the show that also feels very deep. Like, I feel like I'm learning something a little bit. I'm learning mm-hmm. about, maybe it's about me or about people. It gets even crazy. The second season is even crazier. And then the third season's like out of control. It just, the other part of this one is it feels like you said, this one is like, it takes risks. Every episode can be different. Season 2 has got this weird narration by Jon Hamm that doesn't make any sense until like episode 6 or 7. Really? Yeah. It's just so weird. Like, and everything you think, you know, and it's part of the reason when you were telling me like what it's about and trying to explain it to people, you were absolutely right in telling and saying like, this is about this. You think this, you know, you think you're crazy and you hear all these voices and then you find out that it's this. I can tell you that after you watch this whole thing, it's much harder to make that act. That's not the whole story. And that may not even be the intent. And that's what's so cool about this, because every single chapter of this and every single season of this really broadens and brings another kind of element to this show. Plus, there's just some weird ass shit. I like weird ass shit. I like seeing weird ass shit on TV.
I do too. I also like risks. I like things that you look at and you go, how is this on TV? This is awesome. This seems like this never got past the suit. How did this mm-hmm. get past suits? You know, like, how did they say, yeah, okay, go do that for FX?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You know,
well, I think could have done it is Noah, right?
Yeah, Noah Hawley or Howley. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no. I think so. I think there's other creators that could have done it, but I guess not, right? I mean, like,
well, for it's FX, easy to, I mean, it's even, what I'm saying, what I mean is it's easy. So, hey, you want to put on clothes before you go on my live stream? Or are you OnlyFans in it?
There's a person walking by behind Jason. That's all I'm going to say.
Kids, man. Kids. All right.
Like, okay, but what I'm saying, okay, so what were we just saying? We're saying that.
Well, I was saying Noah Hawley, you know, he's got the credibility of doing what he's done with Fargo mm-hmm. for FX. So it's a lot smaller a jump for him than it would be for almost anybody else. They're like, okay, yeah, you could do this. Like, that's what I mean. For FX, there are a lot of people that could have put out a great show and utilized this material, but Noah had the credibility with FX already to make this thing happen as fast as he was able to. And I think probably get away with some stuff other people couldn't. Like, you couldn't do those dance scenes. You couldn't do some of those weirder pieces. And you haven't even got to even close the weirder set pieces. Like,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. There's some crazy shit that starts going on. This one's great. And, you know, but you haven't, you know, we, you still haven't seen the Yellow Man, right? He hasn't actually come out of anybody, right?
We've seen him.
We see the fat guy.
Yeah. But not the Yellow Man.
We haven't seen the Yellow Man.
But here's the thing, Aubrey Plaza, who obviously is just a genius, you know, I mean, she's really something, but I hate her.
Oh yeah.
I hate her. I want to kill her. Like, and that means she's just even that much better. Like, cause she is so, and at first you're like, is she cute? Is she a great best friend? Is she sexy? She's horrible.
She's horrible.
Oh, and she's so annoying and you just want to slam her. And you're just like, oh my God, she's so good. I hate her so much.
She's amazing in this show. And again, she's another one that has an arc and is actually gets to do some stuff here. They really open it up for this cast. Like, I didn't know who Dan Stevens was. My wife obviously knew because he's from,
is that the lead?
Yeah.
Never saw him in my life. Who is this guy?
You've seen him. He's in Downton Abbey.
He's English?
Yeah.
this guy's a Downton Abbey guy.
Yeah, he's great.
Oh, this guy is special. Holy crap. He's Downton Abbey.
Yeah, he's Downton Abbey.
I didn't recognize him.
I didn't either. That's only, I got my wife to watch like 5 minutes of the show because you saw him. He's like, oh, Downton Abbey, I love this.
And she's like, I'm out.
Yeah, and then she goes, I'm going to walk by. Hey, Sarah, come back by and walk around the Bronx.
I mean, in fairness, it was a workout thing.
In fairness, it was not. It was a weird thing that I didn't want to buy that she ended up buying off some Chinese website. And it doesn't matter.
Oh, this is what you get with us. You get it all. You get family life, you get content. We don't mess around.
You get all the stuff. But yeah, he's great. I just think that, you know, we get this stuff from FX, and it's another one of those places that I don't want to ever sleep on. You know, FX is such a cool
devs,
right? Like, and they don't get this. And the thing I think that's weird about it is like devs again and Legion. I don't know if anybody watched them, but us. Right. Like, but it's so great. It feels in a weird sort of way like they're making TV just for me because I don't have anybody else to talk to about except you. And that's why I need you to watch this so bad. But if the rest of the world isn't seeing this, I don't know what they're doing.
It's very interesting. But what we do see is a trend with FX that is, a very smart trend. I don't even want to say a trend. I think it's a mandate. They are creator driven. You know, I mean, taking Noah, and Noah had nothing. You know, he didn't have like major credits before Fargo. And it's the same thing with the Always Sunny guys. You know, they had nothing. They had made a 15-minute pilot that my friend Todd helped shoot. And, John Landgraf buys it and puts it, you know, Landgraf has this kind of crazy genius. You know, he's like a maniacal genius who's like not fear-based at all, which is a rarity in Hollywood. This is a guy who says, you know what? Okay, I like this. You, Billy Bob Thornton, go. And he gets a hit. He's like, okay, this 15-minute little pilot presentation with you bunch of weirdos, genius. Here's a bunch of money. Go make your show. And, you know, Louis C.K., same thing. It's like, you know, no one knew Louis before that show. People knew him. I mean, he had his HBO show, but he was a little cultish kind of guy, you know? He was like the comedian's comedian. Landgraf's like, go, here's $300,000 an episode. Go make your little show. Emmys hits. But I'm saying he does things. But even if you look at the surrealism, and I think that's what it is. I think we see in Fargo, in Legion, in Louis, in what was the other one? In Devs, there is a surrealism that is the undertow of all of these things. Like the Louis show, there's that episode where he's just walking. He's about to go on a blind date and the guy gets hit by the car and his fucking head is decapitated. Right. And you're like thinking, oh, it's a fantasy sequence. It's like, no, this is Salvador Dali's mind. This is the, this is like, that just happened. And I think that is what we see in the risks that FX takes. And I think a lot of times, I mean, I guess they're paying off, but maybe they're not. For me, they are.
Yeah, I mean, they're good. I mean, even I know you didn't really get into the show, but like Dave, right? That one about that. Right, rapper.
Yes.
Also, still surreal for what it was. That could have been a lot more mindless comedy, but they still are digging in, and it's the surrealism, but it's also tied to real emotions and real, like, it may not be it may be a little bit of a fantastical plot, but it's also dealing with emotions, things that just don't get talked about on television as much either.
And
so
by the way,
explore new thoughts and all that stuff.
And isn't Archer on FX? Mm-hmm. Look, that's also surreal. I mean, they'll do an entire season inside his coma brain.
Yep, or four seasons.
Yeah, well, you're not wrong. But again, you know, you're seeing these things that I don't feel most other streamers, or I guess the word network still applies, are doing.
Yep, they do good work. And I'm glad you like the show. And I really am excited to see what you think of the end of this season. And then as we go on, because I think this is one of those ones that do a thing. Oh, we do have a question. Cliff, are you going to support a handlebar mustache soon? I'm trying to listen. All I can watch is your upper lip. I get it. I get it. Cause you're afraid, right? Like so you keep like an eye on it. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. You can go full on. I was going to wonder cause you could go full on Hulk Hogan, right? You can go with the Hogan stash.
If I did it, I'd go convict.
Oh, got it. Got it. Yeah.
Like whatever the
oh, don't worry. You look like you should be arrested right now. Don't give me.
Yeah. But I'm not yet a convict.
Yeah. When you got, yeah.
Once I got arrested, it grows down. Once you get a rap sheet, the mustache grows. The more times you're arrested, the more mustache you have. So, might get a little soul patch.
Oh, you're so funny.
It's not. Yes, Nancy. No, I don't know. I don't even know if I'm going to keep it. It's just worth comedic value right now.
It's like you stole Brooke Shields' left eyebrow put on your face.
I mean, listen, I'm in the process. It's funny. I'm in the process of, I can't really talk about it. You know, but I'm in the process of selling this new movie, I guess, short form content, but it's a franchisable thing. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy about it. But I tell my Dylan today, I tell my son, he's like, it's the new look, Dad. I'm like, don't try to get me to keep this mustache.
No, you should. No, I want you to keep it too. I really do.
Do you?
I will keep a lot of people from asking questions about me and just keep them nice, friendly, focused on you.
Eugene Levy's eyebrow. Just raising it. Okay. So Lee, but I have a lot to look for. Is it renewed or is it over? Is that
three seasons? No, it's over. 3 seasons. The full series is just those 3 seasons. So, but if there's closure in it. It's a really interesting story. All the way through, which I think watching it through a second time, you know, it's definitely one of those ones that hits you kind of in the gut when you realize what the real story is. But in a way that you're completely compelled the entire time.
Okay. So let's take a minute. Cause we only have a few minutes left. Tell me a little about this Nick Cage thing. Cause I saw the Masterpiece Theater, James Lipton beard, and he's by a fireplace with the velvet suit with the ascot. It was exactly how I thought he'd be. You know, but just tell me what the hell's going on with this because I haven't watched it yet.
All right. So it's called History of Swear Words. I'm just going to put it on the screen while we talk so you can see the Nick Cage of it all.
Right. And he's going through these swear words. It's like the etymology. It's the entire history of where like fuck comes from.
Right. Yeah. So basically what you have is you have Nick Cage sitting there. That's the history of pussy. And he just sits there on the couch and he talks about a swear word. So this one's bitch. I'm sure this one's talking about how MILF became a word that they used to, whatever, but it's basically like a, history of the words. It's actual history. And you got really funny people like Sarah Silverman, our boy, Open Mike Eagles in there.
Yeah.
Joel Kim Booster. In this particular one, it's really funny. One of my favorite people in here is this historian. She specializes in the history of swear words, and that's her job. Except every time she swears, she squeaks a little because I don't think she's ever really said swear words, but she's happy to use them all. She's great. But
Nikki Glaser?
Nikki Glaser's in there.
She's funny.
Nick Cage is in here, and he's wearing so much makeup on his face. And he has the same beard that our friend Sean Kittleson has. And so I keep all while I was watching this, like, Sean, you need to go as Nick Cage in the swear words documentary for Halloween next year.
I mean, the only thing Nick has more makeup on, I guess, is more than makeup on his face is dye in that beard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. 100%.
That's like a shoe polish beard.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. It might be a Ron Pope Hill, one of those spray on beards. I wouldn't doubt it.
It's on. And you can tell he's making a joke of it. He's not, you know, is him tongue in cheek. It's not like he's trying to be, oh, I have this beard. He's like, no, how you think I'm going to look? I am going to look. And I'm going to take away all your power from making fun of me because I'm making fun of myself. And that's genius.
Yep. And so it's a real fun. It's tongue in cheek. He doesn't take himself too seriously. None of it is. And you get to learn the etymology and history of words like fuck, bitch, pussy, dick, damn, shit.
Yeah, like what Carlin started, they're trying to finish.
And so they talk about, you know, we learned that, you know, there used to be I didn't realize this, there used to be a even stricter version of the MPAA, and getting damn into Gone with the Wind was a very difficult task.
Yeah, you know, and they'll use the, you know, what's always found so interesting. I know we have to wrap up. They'll use the word damn, but if someone says, you know, God, I don't like to use the word, but they'll bleep God. They won't bleep damn.
Right. Cause God,
damn, fascinating.
Yeah, it's definitely really interesting. There's a lot of stuff in there about that. Those kind of, Yeah, yeah. They talk about like how God, you know, with goddamn or dick, where you can't call, you can call somebody a dick, but you can't refer to it as a dick. So if you like dick's beep is right. being a dick, you could get two dicks. One, only one of those three would be bleeped.
Right. But stuff. If you say, look at my dick, it's getting bleeped.
Right.
Right. But if you go, look at dick.
If you said dick, look at my bleep, right?
Yeah. That you would get one in and one out.
One in, one out. Right. Story of your sex tape.
You might have convinced me to watch this. I'm just saying.
Here's what I'm going to tell everybody, and I know we got to go, okay. But watch. It's one of those things where you can just watch it whenever you feel like, right? Like, it's not something that you have to burn through if you don't want to, but it's something like in between. Like, if you, we watch some heavy shit sometimes. Yeah. Like, and I was just talking with Kevin Andrew on Stereo. If you get a chance to listen to it, everybody else, but we did a whole talk with Keith Andrew on David Lynch and specifically on Twin Peaks. The Showtime version of Twin Peaks is a lot. It's a lot of work sometimes because it's very heavy and there's a lot of stuff going on. You got to really pay attention. It's a perfect like palate cleanser when you're like, I still got to go to bed, but I have these frog moths stuck in my brain. And let me listen to Nick Cage say fuck 20 different ways.
And you can watch them out of order.
Exactly. Exactly.
So there's just pick a curse word you like and watch it.
That's right.
I like it. All right. Well, we will be back Friday with our no guest Friday, which is, I can say days, right? Can mm-hmm. I say days? All right. Well, so, all right. This has been, I mean, again, it goes by in 2 seconds. This is a job. I can't believe it. Thank you all for making this our job. For real. So everyone stay safe, stay sane, stay strong. Jason Smith.
Cliff Dorfman. I love you, everybody. Have a great fucking day.